Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. I'm your host, Dan Sampson, and I'm joined today by NAHU Government Affairs staff members John Green and Chris Hartman. On this week's episode, we'll discuss recent IRS guidance on the maximum HSA contribution and the small business tax credit, a revived discussion about attempting yet another repeal and replace attempt ahead of the November elections, and NAHU's efforts to advance legislation to make needed reforms to HSAs. Reminder, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these channels ahead of being distributed through the Washington Update, giving loyal listeners an opportunity to get a head start on their weekly healthcare happy hour. With that, I want to welcome our panelists to the show once more. Today we are joined by NAHU's lobbyists, John Green and Chris Hartman. As we start off the podcast this week, what has been the big whoop?
Well, Dan, this week, the big whoop is HHS Secretary Alex Azar's proposal to push the healthcare market towards value-based design.
As you mentioned, HHS Secretary Alex Azar has been making increased pushes for value-based care. What should NAHU members be telling their clients about the ongoing push for value-based programs over the coming years?
Well, let's start a little bit with just defining what value-based design means. Currently in the healthcare system, it's traditionally a fee-for-service model that you, the individual, goes to the doctor, the hospital, others, prescription drug, you use your insurance there, and then the insurance carrier pays a predetermined rate that was maybe negotiated with the hospital beforehand, negotiated with the doctors, negotiated with the prescription drug company, and that is the traditional model. Value-based design is about first, tailoring your health insurance to you. So designing a plan around that particular individual and their ongoing health needs. Maybe they have things like diabetes that's going to require ongoing treatment. And if you make the treatments for diabetes more affordable, people are more likely to actually take up that treatment. And in the long run, you're actually saving the insurance company, the employers, and the individual money by treating the chronic disease without delay. Also within the value-based design, we're talking about moving towards paying for things that actually work. So much of what we pay for in healthcare is just based on historic negotiated service levels. So if a hospital or a pharmaceutical has negotiated at a particular price with a carrier, that's the price it's going to be regardless of what the drug or the surgery or others does for the individual or the long-term consequences of those surgeries, of those prescription drugs. It's a real push to move towards things that actually work, that are proven to have a positive outcome for individuals. And so maybe you incentivize the individual to go in a direction that they're going for physical therapy as opposed to surgery, because physical therapy has been proven to work for their particular problem over surgery. Or maybe a particular drug has been shown over 5-10 year studies to have a better outcome for the individual than a drug that currently might be priced better, but is only priced better based on historic perceptions of negotiations that have been done there. So value-based design is really about steering people towards what actually works. And in the long run, I think value-based design has the best chance for really bending that cost curve in healthcare, and so that we're not paying for things that haven't worked at very expensive levels, and we are paying for things that do work. And we might even be incentivizing individuals to move in that direction by including those things in a pre-deductible level. So you're even encouraged to use it because it might be free or at no cost. And then putting those things that are not shown to work to be at either in your deductible or at a much higher copay.
The IRS released two notices last week, one that corrects the HSA maximum contribution limit that was changed with last year's sweeping tax reform package, and another that gives more small employers the ability to claim the ACA's small business tax credit. What can you tell us about these notices?
In May of 2017, last year, when the IRS announced the family cap at $6,900, lawyers put that all in place and everything was administratively set. But as you mentioned, because of the tax bill, they actually lowered it by $50, which is a huge administrative hassle. And in March of 2018, they released that notice declaring the $50 reduction. Since that time, just a month later or so on April 26th, they've granted relief to affected taxpayers by allowing the original announced $6,900 family coverage HSA contribution cap to remain in effect for this year, citing, of course, numerous unanticipated administrative and financial burdens in response to the $50 reduction. So now for 2018, the HSA contribution limit for account holders with self-only coverage through a high deductible health plan will be $3,450 as announced in the May 2017 and not adjusted since.
Yeah, I think this is good news because so many agents and brokers were talking to me, why did we just change this by $50? $50 change downwards is really just more of a bureaucratic hassle for employers and their plans and a matter of changing all the paperwork than any real substantive value. Of course, that was all because of changes the way we count the consumer price index that was done by the tax bill. I don't think this was the purpose of the tax bill, but it had sort of the unintended consequences of it. And so it's great to see the IRS responding to our complaints and other complaints and going back to the number for HSAs that we've been using over the past couple of years. IRS continues to give us lots of little presents. Last week, another one was on the small business tax credit. It's already been so hard for small businesses to qualify for the small business tax credit. But one of the problems they ran into this particular year is how in many markets, there were no small business plans in the shop exchange whatsoever. And the only way you were able to qualify for the tax credit before is if you purchased a plan through the shop. So what this change in the IRS notice says is if there is no plan available in the shop, you are still eligible for that tax credit and you can use it outside the shop. Obviously, there's a lot of restrictions around this small business tax credit. It's only available for 2 years. It's only available for certain salary limits that I think have excluded a lot of people. But I think the final kick in the pants this last year was the fact that even if you figured out how to get your small business to qualify in so many other ways, there was no plan available whatsoever to choose from. And so the IRS has addressed that and says you can use that outside of the shop now. And so several small employers are very happy to see that.
It's a great new flexibility. And I think we'll see these sorts of flexibilities applied in other areas if the market continues to deteriorate.
NAHU activated its Operation Shout system this week to promote bipartisan HSA legislation that would make needed reforms roughly 14 years after HSAs entered the market. What are these proposed reforms, and when might Congress act on them?
Yeah, so John and I and NAHU have been advocating for some reforms to HSAs. And really, these are questions about what you can do with your HSA. If you're in a high deductible healthcare plan paired with an HSA, a lot of Americans are now in those plans. The market's really moved that way in the last 5 to 10 years. And so the problem is there are so many restrictions around what you can do with that HSA. And HSAs came into beginning, as Dan said, about 14 years ago. And really, the world's changed since then. So what this bill does is allow people to use their HSAs for certain things that did not exist before. For example, telemedicine. There was no ability to do telemedicine over the internet several years ago. And so when HSAs were put into existence, it was very clear and they outlined exactly what HSAs could be used for. But this wasn't even something that existed. So now under this bill that we're promoting, HSAs could be used for that. Another thing that happened is under the ACA, you can keep your children on your health insurance plan up to age 26. That sounds great. But HSAs don't let them go up to 26 because it was designed at a very different time. So now under the bill that we are promoting, you can use your HSA for your children up to the age 26 if they're still on your healthcare plan. So there's been lots of little pieces of ideas, legislation that have been introduced on a bipartisan level and on what you can do your HSAs. And now we've put them together in this nice package that has been introduced in the House by Representative Kelly and Representative Blumenauer to say that these changes that both Democrats and Republicans agree need to take place because the market has changed over the last several years should pass as a package. A lot of these items have been scored. They've been relatively small prices. So we want to really move these common sense changes to HSAs and allow consumers to have more ability to truly use their HSA for what works and the way the market looks today.
There are a lot of common sense changes here. As Chris pointed out, they have not changed since it became law. Employers now have clinics at the work site. You can't use it in conjunction with that. But there's even better opportunities for primary care and chronic conditions to use it to stay healthy. Employers use a lot of wellness programs. So it just make the interaction work a lot better. I think that because employers are moving to full replacement to high deductible health plans, Democrats need them to work as well as Republicans. And since we're not talking about expanding the parameters or the size of the accounts themselves, it's just using the money that exists in the account more efficiently so that it works better for everybody.
Yeah, there are lots of things that continue to be a problem for individuals. For example, some people like direct primary care, where you pay your physician a monthly fee to be in their system. HSAs don't let you do that. And I know there's one particular group in the Washington metro area, one medical group that is set up that way. And if you're using your HSA to pay that currently, you could be tracked down by the IRS for making those sorts of payments. And so I think we just need to evolve and update HSAs to the way healthcare works today. And I think the great piece about this legislation is that this is something that has bipartisan buy-in. Both Democrats and Republicans agree that if you're going to have an HSA, you'd be able to use it for your healthcare needs that exist today. One of the proposals that's in this package is related to sports and fitness. So for youth fitness activities, maybe it's a soccer team, the football team, so many activities that involve fitness today and health today are things you have to pay for. And years ago, parents didn't have to pay to have their kids on the soccer team, but maybe now they do. One of the changes that this bill would allow your HSA account to pay for things that are good for personal health, like physical activities out there that are now, unfortunately, have fees involved with them, and they've never had fees involved before. So I think as the economy continues to evolve, as healthcare continues to evolve, we need to make sure HSAs continue to evolve.
The White House has expressed support for HSA improvements. We met with them just this week to talk about that. The Ways and Means Committee is expected sometime in the next 6 weeks to take up this issue once they clear the decks of the opioid.
We will be doing an operations shout so you can let your members of Congress know that you are supportive of these changes. I think these changes have a good possibility of still getting done this particular year. I think because this is a less polarized area where it's really about if you have an HSA, we want to make sure that you can use it. This will be something that I think that both Democrats and Republicans, even with us being an election year, will be interested in passing. And it will be good for consumers and good for brokers who are talking about it, HSAs with their clients. Because now you have to let them know about all the restrictions that are on the HSAs, and we'd like to loosen some of those up for you guys.
Former Senator Rick Santorum, a leading voice on last year's Graham-Cassidy plan, has revived talks of Congress making another attempt at repealing and replacing the ACA ahead of the November elections. What is the likelihood that Congress makes another attempt or is successful, given the Republicans have even fewer votes in both chambers now than they did last year?
Well, my personal opinion is nil going into the elections. I think that is just too dicey. You know, you'd have to be assured of the numbers going in, that you had the votes. And it always comes back to what does replace look like? Repealing is one thing, but you've only done half the job. I'd like Senator Alexander's tact of a more thoughtful, let's go back and actually think about the policy rather than the process-driven reconciliation nightmare that they went through last year. Post-election, I don't see it then either. I know that Secretary Price has expressed some optimism or belief that perhaps something could be done after the midterms, but I'm still skeptical of that happening in that short of time frame when there are so many other things that need to get done at the end of the year. It's a very tight calendar from here to the end, and trying to shoehorn something that enormous into that schedule just seems preposterous to me.
Yeah, I think there's always going to be part of the Republican base that wants to repeal Obamacare and will always be a priority of theirs, regardless what time of the year we're talking about, what else is going on, or if there is an idea of what they should actually be doing with replace. I think Rick Santorum really represents a lot of that base and that anger the Tea Party side of the Republican Party has and will always have when it comes to the ACA. And so I think they'll be looking to do this at regardless of what time of year we're talking about. I think, John, you make a great point, though, but as we get closer to election, if I'm a Republican who's in a swing district, maybe a district that Hillary Clinton won or a district that has always been sort of marginal, I don't really want to talk about this right now. I don't really want to be forced to take another vote as we get closer to election day on repealing Obamacare. We've watched over the last year or two as Obamacare and the ACA's approval numbers have actually gone up, and people are more supportive of the ACA than they were several years ago when it was passed or under the years of the Obama administration. And so if I'm a Republican in one of these swing districts, I don't want to be forced to walk the plank on another repeal and replace bill just before the election. And if I'm in the House, I'm even more annoyed because this is even less likely to pass in the Senate when the Republicans lost a Senate seat in Alabama this year. So they're even less likely to be able to get support for repeal of the ACA than they were before. So why should I have to take this vote now? So I agree, John. I know there's another big push coming from Rick Santorum and others to see a Graham Cassidy plan or some other attempt to happen this summer. But I just don't see that there is the political will. And I think that both Speaker Ryan and Mitch McConnell know that would be political suicide.
And this particular proposal in of itself is not, to me, a fully fleshed out, full-fledged replacement idea. It has a lot of flaws in it. It's going to take time to straighten out those flaws if it's going to be effective. You don't want to pass something that won't work. That's not of any use either. So there just isn't the time or bandwidth to really address it. And this doesn't do it.
It's now time for the Senior Moment, our weekly review of the key happenings in Medicare and long-term care. John, as NIHU's lead of these issue areas, what is your Senior Moment of the week?
So I want to talk about the broker bill. I'm not talking about the MLR bill, and I'm not talking about the COBRA bill. This is a broker bill that addresses broker commission issues and other issues related to Medicare Advantage. So specifically, we're going to deal with the scope of appointment, which restricts conversations to only those topics that are agreed to within the scope and assigned by the beneficiary and the agent. But when you arrive at the home, how often does the conversation drift to maybe something else that's outside that scope? Well, you have to fill out another scope and come back on another day. And in rural areas, this can be a real challenge. So what we're going to be asking for is that there be standardized language that says that you can talk about a set of issues that allows you to assess initial needs, financial and medical, from the outset. It's only those things that are beyond the normal things that you would discuss. So, for example, you would probably talk about Medicare Advantage. You might talk about medical supplements and things like that. So, but it would not allow for immediate cross-selling. That is a no-no. Once you've established and you are the agent of record and they are your client, then you can talk about those sorts of things. We also propose allowing agents and brokers to perform routine servicing activities as the agent of record to facilitate change of address requests, assist with claim issues, and other functions on behalf of their clients with the carrier. Currently, CMS doesn't allow that, and in our discussions with them, don't appear to be willing to allow that. So therefore, we need a legislative fix to address that. Going forward, we also want CMS to allow professional agent organizations such as NEHU to be included in any conversations on proposed rules that directly affect agent brokers in the same way that they include carriers in discussions that affect the carrier world. So, for example, if they're going to propose something that affects agents and brokers, then we would like to be included in a conversation so we can talk about what the market impact of what they are proposing and to identify, is there actually an issue or a problem here relative to the beneficiary, or can this be appropriately addressed through another mechanism? So a good example of that is a rule that says that on first-year commissions, you're only allowed 1/12 of the first-year commission based on when the beneficiary's birthday occurs. That just came out of the blue and has very bad market implications in that an agent doesn't want to sign up someone in December for 1/12 of the commission, given the level of work that's involved is the same in December as it is in January. This is not a good consumer protection in my view, and we're hoping to end that sort of thing going forward. So that is my senior moment, and we are very close, I should say, to having a champion for this broker bill in the House, and we'll let you know in the coming weeks when we've got that nailed down.
Before we wrap up the show for the week, what's on tap for next week?
Well, Dan, next week Congress is back, so both the House and the Senate are back in town, and so things will be busy on that side. I think opioids will continue to be one of the hot healthcare topics that Congress is debating and discussing. We will pay close attention to that. From some of what we talked about in previous weeks on mental health parity and the possibility of fining employers for not having adequate mental health networks that can address opioid abuse. But we'll also be watching the opioid discussions to make sure that our workforce is able to get help, because I talked to so many brokers and so many employers who can't have employees who are constantly missing work or unproductive because of the problems that are going on with opioids out there. So I expect in the next few weeks that this will continue to be the hot topic on the healthcare side within Congress. Along with that, NEHU will have a very busy week. We'll be at the White House talking healthcare policy with their leaders and talking about how we can make regulatory changes to improve the market there and make sure employers stay in the healthcare system. I think for us that always keeping small business and large business in the healthcare system and offering employers will always be one of the hot topics. And so that conversation will continue to be hot in the White House, and NEHU will be part of that. And, you know, we're waiting for a proposed rule on HRAs to come out. I don't know if it will be next week, but at some point soon, we expect to see that sort of information coming out. And we also expect a little later this summer, a final rule on association healthcare plans. So I think next week will be busy as usual.
It's now time for the toast of the week. What are we celebrating this week as we head into the Cinco de Mayo weekend?
Well, Dan, for me personally, I am celebrating the fact that drug manufacturers and medical device people have invented pills, nasal sprays, and drops to deal with all the allergens that are out there. It's been so much blooming here in Washington, D.C., so this week I'm toasting to medical inventions to deal with allergies.
Yeah.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NEHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NEHU's government affairs efforts and to join as a member of NEHU, visit nehu.org.